This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be wrapping up the Sci-Fi Book Club with a discussion of Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. Have a burning thought about that gloomy biotech dystopia? The pigoons, the re-engineered human beings, or anything else? Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. But first, the Olympics may be over, but the threat of Zika still looms large. In fact, while the CDC is keeping its collective eye on two clusters of Zika infections in Florida, government officials expect the virus will inevitably spread. In the meantime, a new study suggests that Zika may have a long-term impact on healthy adult mouse brains, which could portend bad news for humans. Here to give us an update on those things and where things stand with Zika is Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Dr. Fauci, welcome back to Science Friday.
Good to be with you, Ira.
Let's start with the news out today that the FDA is recommending that all donated blood be tested for Zika.
Yes, that is correct, and I think that's prudent and a good idea, Ira, for a number of reasons. You know, there are at least 2,500 individuals in this country with travel-related Zika. Namely, they got Zika in another country, very likely South America, Central America, or the Caribbean, and come to the United States, or are Americans who go there, visit, and come back. So those are the minimum amount. There are probably many more than that because a lot of people who get, about 80% of people who get infected with Zika don't know they're infected. So there is the possibility that there will be an inadvertent entry into the blood supply, a unit of blood donated innocently by someone who was infected with Zika and had no idea that they were infected. So screening of the blood, I think, is the prudent thing to do and is something that will make the blood supply safe and prevent the dissemination of Zika by yet again another mechanism, the blood supply. We know it can be transmitted by mosquitoes. We know it can be transmitted sexually. You want to protect the blood supply to the extent you can. So I think this was a good idea on the part of the FDA.
You know, it's people are going to finally listening more about it, and now that it's gotten a lot of coverage, first with the Olympics and now in Florida. And people are paying, as I say, more attention. They're going to be sitting on an airplane wondering, you know, if I'm going to Florida or coming back from Florida and somebody sneezes on me, is that a transmission method?
No, absolutely not. I'm glad you brought that up. And it's always the case when you have communicable diseases, when you have diseases that are spread, infections, there's always the concern about what is the mechanism of spread. It is spread predominantly and overwhelmingly by mosquito bites. By a mosquito biting an infected person and then biting someone who's not infected. We also know now that it has been documented cases of sexual transmission, mostly from men to women, but also a case or so that goes from a woman to a man. And we do know from experience in other countries that when Zika gets into the blood supply, you can transmit it by blood transfusions. And that's really the reason for the recent action by the FDA.
I want to ask you about this Zika mouse study, about the problems with the brains of the mice. Can you explain what the researchers found there?
Yeah, what they found, Ira, and I want to make sure people don't get the wrong impression from this and make more out of it than is justified at this point. It's a study that you should take seriously, but you have to remember it's a mouse study in which the investigators infected adult mice with Zika to see if there was any effect on the adult brain. We know that the virus clearly has a very deleterious effect on the developing brain, hence the congenital abnormalities that we're seeing in people who get infected with Zika during their pregnancy, pregnant women, particularly in the first trimester. But this was a different question. This was the question is what happens to the adult brain? And what the investigators showed is that when you infect an adult mouse, that you can get stem cells in the brain that can get infected. So that is something you want to pay attention to, but what was not shown was whether or not the animals, it had any effect on their function at all, or what the physiological or clinical relevance that might be. So people will immediately ask the question, well, if an adult gets infected with Zika, are you going to have an effect on their brain? If you look at the tens of thousands of people who've been infected with Zika, there's no indication, although it wasn't formally followed in a study, there was no indication that infection of an adult has any impact negatively on the brain of that adult. Having said that, you want to take animal studies seriously and make sure you keep an eye out for the possibility that you might be missing some subtle effects. But thus far, it does not look like there are any in the adult human.
Let's talk about what's going on with the flooding in Louisiana. Is that making it more likely that Zika will show up there because of all that water in the breeding grounds?
Well, it's a complicated story when you're talking about flooding, Ira, that sometimes can be confusing. Floods in general, when you just take floods as a flood, generally wipe out mosquito propagation places and eggs and larvae and things. But following flooding, when the flood resides in some situations, and there isn't necessarily a lot of direct proof of that, you can have standing water that could be a problem. But even as important as that is that in areas where there are flood, around the areas that don't necessarily flood, there's a lot of rain. And when you have a lot of rain, that's when you have a lot of standing water, and that's where you can get the problem. So anything that contributes to standing water could potentially, and I underline potentially, have a negative effect on what you're trying to do in getting rid of the mosquitoes.
Would you be surprised if Zika does not spread further than Florida where it is now?
No, I would not be surprised if it does not spread. I do not think, although you have to be prepared for any possibility, I do not think that we're going to see a disseminated type of a Zika outbreak similar to what was seen in Brazil in January and February and what we are currently seeing in Puerto Rico. But it is not unlikely that we will see what we're already seeing in Florida, namely individual cases and some cases of clusters and ongoing transmission like we're seeing in the Windward section and in the South Beach section of Miami Beach. It is possible that this would just shut down and we won't see any more. I think that's unlikely, Ara. I think we're going to see a few more cases. Hopefully the aggressive mosquito control activities of the Florida authorities together with the CDC are going to prevent it from becoming significantly more than it is. So if we see no other cases, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think that's the case. I think we're going to see a few more. And if we see a few more, I'm not going to be that surprised by it because there are so many people who have travel-related cases. There are about 500 of them in Florida. So the opportunity for mosquitoes to bite an infected person and pass it on to someone else are there. Hopefully, mosquito control methods will prevent that from becoming widespread.
Well, isn't it not true that most people or many people who have the virus don't know they have the virus?
Exactly, and that's the reason why the numbers, when you talk about infected people, it's always an underestimate. 80% of people who are infected with Zika don't know they're infected. They have no symptoms. 20% of them have a relatively mild illness: fever, rash, aches and pains, and some red eye or conjunctivitis. So there's a proportion of people, the majority, don't know they're infected.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the state of coming up with a Zika virus vaccine. Where are we in that?
Well, we've been accelerating our pace of a vaccine development. We started on August the 2nd, a phase one trial of one of about four or five candidates that are lined up in succession to go into trial. Phase one means you're just asking, is it safe and does it induce the kind of response that you would predict would be protective? We started it on August 2nd. There's going to be 80 people in the trial. It's going to take place in Bethesda, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., in Emory in Atlanta, and in the University of Maryland at Baltimore. We should finish that by the end of 2016, November or December. And then if we get the resources, we're going to transition quickly into a phase two trial that's going to look at maybe between 2,400 and 5,000 people in areas where there's active transmission to see if it works. So we're really right on a pathway of multiple candidates to determine if we can get a vaccine. That's on an accelerated pace.
But you put your finger on the $64. I know it's going to be a lot more expensive than that. Question, and last time you were on a few weeks ago when we talked about this, you said that there was enough congressional money, enough money in the budget to pay for the phase one trial, but right, there was not enough for the phase two part. And you
that
said,
is that still the case? That's still the case. So what happened, Ira, is that to get the sites prepared for the phase two, Secretary Burwell had to use her transfer authority to move money out of other components of NIH to give to the vaccine effort for my institute, which was hurtful to cancer research, to heart, lung, and blood research, to diabetes research. That money is going to get me through September, but if we don't get an appropriations in fiscal 2017, I will not be able to proceed with the phase two trial in January and February of 2017. That would really be a shame because that would interrupt the smooth flow of that pathway to a vaccine.
So you would need a lame duck version of Congress to come back and appropriate the money.
Well, yeah, that's what we're hoping for, Ira. We really hope that Congress does appropriate the money to allow us, not only NIH, but also CDC. CDC is playing a major role in things like mosquito control in certain areas, partnering with the state and local health authorities. So they're in the same boat as we are, that at the end of this fiscal year, at the end of September, we're essentially running out of money.
So you really think that Congress will do this, come back and, you know, give you the money? This is such a political football now, the season that we're in.
Yeah, I hope so, Ira. I really do. I'm just hoping that they do that because, you know, they've risen to the occasion of the past in emergencies. I hope they do that here so that we can get going and continue to do what we're doing.
Well, the unfortunate good news, I guess, about that is it's getting the attention. It's getting in Florida where people are noticing it.
Well, certainly they're noticing in Florida when you have two neighborhoods that where you have a guideline that pregnant women should not go to those neighborhoods. I mean, that's an eye-opener for people.
Dr. Fauci, as always, thank you for taking time out of your busy day to come talk with us.
It's always good to be with you, Ira.
And Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH. We're going to take a break, come back, the book club. Time to call the book club back in session. We're going to talk about Margaret Atwood's vision of the future Oryx. And Craig, did you read it? Please tell us about what you liked about it. 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll talk about all those interesting things. We actually interviewed Margaret earlier in the week here in New York. We might have a little bit of that to talk about. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In a fictional future United States, the climate near Boston resembles Florida. Voting doesn't matter anymore. And while everything and everyone else scramble to survive, scientists live and work in isolated, amenity-rich compounds on biotech projects that re-engineer life, ranging from pigs and chickens to humans. The Sci-Fi Book Club read all about it in Margaret Atwood's 2003 dystopia, Oryx and Crake, this month. We followed Jimmy, Snowman, Crake, and Oryx literally to the end of the world. We even talked about it with Margaret Atwood herself earlier this week. And now it's time to bring the club to order and talk about it with you. It's if you've been reading along, how about sharing? Share your favorite or your most frightening Oryx and Crake moments. Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guests, guest readers. Annalee Newitz is tech culture editor at Ars Technica, author of the book Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She also has her own dystopian novel, Autonomous, coming out in the fall. Welcome back, Annalee.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Terry Johnson is an associate professor teaching at bioengineering at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the co-author of How to Defeat Your Own Clone. We need to know that. And other tips for surviving the biotech revolution. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And our producer, Christy Taylor, is back, too. Hi, Christy.
Hey, Ira.
Let's talk for book club newbies. Give us a little thumbnail of what Oryx and Crake is about.
Sure. So as you sort of introduced yourself, this is a biotech dystopia where scientists are doing some crazy things, reengineering human beings, even to the point where we allegedly don't have religion anymore, but also dying in large numbers from a mysterious virus that has shook the world. And so we meet Jimmy, who is the last man on Earth, kind of pathetically crawling through survival. And he reminisces about growing up with his best buddy, Crake, who ends up being quite the brilliant scientist. And we follow along through that world and question ultimately whether it was worth saving or whether the destruction was a good idea.
Right. Terry Johnson, you said this book gave you a lot to think about as someone who teaches young scientist, because the main character, Kraken, there is a scientist who sort of he changes the whole world to the way he wants it.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it, it's a dystopia in many ways, but it's definitely an educational dystopia. You have the numbers people being separated away from other pursuits that make them unable to think about problems. They think about problems in one way, via numbers, and they're separated from the sorts of people and the sorts of experiences that would round them out as human beings and engineers and scientists.
Yeah, and so instead of trying to integrate the humanities with the sciences, he separates them right out, makes them a different class. Annalie, you reread Oryx and Crake for us. What parts of it have repeatedly stood out most to you?
You know, the thing to me that's so interesting about this novel is that it's really a utopia wrapped in a dystopia. And you don't see that a lot in classic dystopian fiction. If you think about stuff like 1984 or even more recently The Road, usually these are novels that don't really leave you with much hope. And even if there is a moment of hope, you know, it's sort of strangled out of the main character and it's crushed. And, you know, this novel ends, and I think it's okay to give a spoiler since we've all read it, but this novel ends with kind of, you know, this clumsy effort to rebuild humanity by re-engineering our bodies, which I think is very problematic, and we can talk more about that. Yeah. But it is a sense of hope, and this is the first novel in a trilogy. I highly urge people to read the next two books in the trilogy, The Flood and Mad Adam, because the utopian elements go in this really weird direction. And I think that's something that we really just need to think about as readers. Like, what is the utopia that Atwood is suggesting that we kind of come away with here?
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have Margaret Atwood in New York to sit down with me and talk about the book and talk about some of the science and the hope in it. She talked about that also that has changed since she wrote it. Christy, you were
I helped. We had a great team put this event together. Margaret was here. We got to talk to her, and she had some reflections about how science since 2003 has made, she thinks CRISPR, for example, makes someone like a Crake more likely. It makes it a little easier for someone to remake humans. And then we also had a really great listener question. Kristen in Brooklyn, who works in biotech herself, she had a question about geneticist Craig Venter's forays into synthetic biology.
He was recently back in the news talking about synthesizing an entire human genome from scratch. And I was curious about, you know, whether you'd heard about that, what your thoughts are about it, and whether you think that we are responsible enough as a society and as scientists to wield that kind of power in synthetic biology at this point.
Are we responsible enough? No. is that going to stop us? No. This is Pandora's box. It's already open. So anytime you give human beings a new toy, they play with it. And they often play with it very creatively and sometimes with unintended consequences.
That wasn't good. Hold on.
Wow. Terry Johnson, ethics aside, did this science, sophisticated gene splicing, giving human animals traits, growing organs in pigs, did it sound technically feasible, possible? Does CRISPR make this happen?
Well, it's definitely based on real science, but the real science is a lot more difficult. CRISPR is a really powerful tool for editing DNA, but it doesn't tell you how you would edit the DNA to create an organism with particular traits. And that's something that we know fairly little about. We're learning more every day, but it's still an extremely difficult problem.
Are you as worried as Margaret was about the future?
I think that when you develop a powerful tool, you need to think very carefully about how you use it. And I'm definitely somebody who thinks that this is something that we should be talking about. And by we, I don't mean just scientists, but scientists, policymakers, and people in the public.
Mm-hmm. Annalie, your book is subtitled Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. So I would imagine you're a little closer to being fearful. about?
Yes and no, because of course I'm also interested in how you survive a terrible event. You know, the thing about this novel's dystopia is that I think a lot, it's easy to say it's a dystopia about biotechnology because, you know, that's how they destroy the world is by creating this kind of, you know, ridiculous pill, Bliss Plus, that everyone wants to take and then it turns them into goo, you know, after they take it. But, you know, it's really, I think, much more a nightmare about what happens when corporations control the future of science. And it's because what we really see as the ultimate dystopia here is that growing divide between or just massive divide between the rich and the poor, the rich people who live in these domed cities full of plenitude, and then the people in the plebe lands who have very impoverished lives, no access to the biotechnology that's available to the rich people. And, you know, a lot of the satire and the dark humor in the book is really aimed at how corporations monetize biotech, you know, consumer biotech like pharmaceuticals that you take to be pretty or pharmaceuticals you take to feel nice, things that aren't strictly necessary to survive. And I think to me, that is the part that's really terrifying. It feels very real, even though it's, of course, exaggerated and comic. It feels, especially with how pharmaceutical companies have been behaving lately in terms of kind of jacking up the price on pills just for fun, you know, it feels dangerously close to happening.
Our number 844-724-8255, talking about Oryx and Crake and what you might have thought about the book. Terry, and both of you, what struck me most about the humans Crake made is their absence of things that I would consider crucial to humanity: art, romantic love, symbolic thinking of all kinds. Are those really the roots of problems with what is the individuals that are being created as you see it?
The line where Crake raises a glass at the idea that he's engineered humor out of the Crakers was probably the most chilling line in the book for me. I think Crake is treating life like one of his video games, and he's trying to figure out what the win condition is. And the Crakers are described as these humans that have all of these modifications that have been put in. It's like he's throwing genetic modification as cheat codes and trying to create something that will last forever. But he's taken out all of the things that he sees as causing problems, the things that human beings struggle with. And I'm less sure that there's a utopia wrapped in a dystopia. I think that either Crake has failed and the Crakers are going to have the same sorts of problems that we have, or maybe even more likely that they're genuinely different and they're going to discover problems that he couldn't even imagine, partially because he's human, but also because he lives in a society that hasn't prepared him to think about those things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
Terry,
I really liked something you said to me when we were talking about this book earlier. Crake, as a scientist, shows remarkably little thought to evolution where the Crakers are concerned. They're not going to change.
Hmm. Right. He's designed something and just assumed that he won, that there's no reason for them to change, environment's not going to change.
Right. And he's really neglected the fact that there's going to be a huge cultural impact on them. And that's one of the things I love about that scene where he shows off the Crakers to Jimmy, because it is so, rereading it, I was struck by how naive he really is, where he says, well, we've engineered out racism because they don't see color, which just sounds like a complete, I mean, it's just Margaret Atwood being a goof. You know, she's satirizing that idea. And the idea that they won't have sexual anxiety because they go into heat, which to me seems like it would just raise all kinds of new anxieties. They also eat their own poop, and that's just supposed to be, you know, and to Crake, who's thinking in this very kind of techie mindset, he's thinking, well, of course, that's very sustainable and that will, you know, allow them to understand the environment better. And even as he's saying this stuff at the end of the book. We've already read enough of the book to know that, of course, none of these things have really helped them avoid the problems that humans had. And they're already evolving their own culture. And so because of the fact that Craik has been put into this environment where, as Terry said earlier, he's not exposed to any thought from the humanities, he's not exposed to sociology, he hasn't even considered, well, what happens when you put a bunch of intelligent primates together? You know, they start inventing culture and they start doing things in a ritualistic way. And it doesn't help that you've made them eat their own poop because they'll figure out some other way to destroy the environment.
Mm. I hate to drop in on that sentence. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about Oryx and Craik with Annalee Newitz, Terry Johnson, and Christy Taylor. Christy, you were there. Did Margaret want to scare us with this book, you think, into thinking extinction is the only way to fix our problems, getting rid of everybody else, starting over again?
Well, she didn't say that. She thinks that this is something to think about, and I think we can listen to her say that herself.
Did you think of Craik as a sort of a messianic figure?
Well, he thinks of himself that way.
Yeah,
you may not agree with him. You may think that we might solve our problems in a less radical way. And I certainly hope you will think that. This is not my desired model of how we should be spending the next 30 years.
Was it something to scare us? This is the opposite of the model.
I don't think people get radically scared by books of fiction. I think they may ponder. They may think. I don't think they're going to run screaming out into the street.
I don't think so, but it gets people to think. Annalee, what is the appeal or the importance of reading dystopia for you?
I think it's really important for a lot of the reasons that Atwood described in that talk that she gave, where it allows you to think through problems that we're encountering, emerging problems in our civilization. It serves as a warning. And, you know, this book is very much a warning about, you know, if we continue to allow business to control science, if we continue to see a gap between rich and poor that grows larger and larger, this is the kind of future that we're likely to see. At the same time, as I mentioned earlier, I think she does suggest that even in the darkest moment of our civilization, there will be people bumbling toward trying to create a better world. They might do it in a way that we wouldn't prefer, but it is things are going to continue. Humans are going to continue in some form at the end of this book, and may not be better, but it certainly won't be worse.
Mm-hmm. And Terry, the reading dystopia to you, what does it do for you?
I think that reading dystopia isn't about the particular future or avoiding it, but really reaching out to individuals who might, without the book, move us in that general direction. I think making people ponder, if there's people that read that book and are considering a project or investing in something or supporting something, and they think, is this a little too Oryx and Craik? Then that has done its job.
Do you make your students read it?
I'll consider it.
I mean, if they're going into science and bioengineering, you're a professor of bioengineering, and this is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, do they think about the consequences of the field they're going into?
Definitely. We just had my first class for the first year engineers, and just asked them about technologies that had ethical issues associated with it that they think about, and that could take up multiple class periods. Young people have plenty to say about the field that they're going into and the things that they think about it.
And they do think about it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We're gonna come back and think more about it after this short break. Coming back with Annalee Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica, Terry Johnson, associate professor of bioengineering, University of California, Berkeley, and Christy Taylor, our sci-fi producer. Stay with us. Our number is 844-724-8255. Hopefully we can get to a few calls before we have to conclude this segment. You can also tweet us at SciFry SCIFRI. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about Margaret Atwood's biotech dystopia, Oryx and Crake, as we continue this meeting of the Sci-Fi Book Club with Annalee Newitz, tech cultured editor at Ars Technica, Terry Johnson, associate professor of bioengineering at UC Berkeley, and Christy Taylor, our sci-fi producer. Our number, 844-724-8255. We have some tweets coming in, a couple of phone calls. Let's see if we can get to them. Tweets. Jerry German says, in the 1950s, we had dystopia views of science gone awry with giant spiders, dragons. I see the roots of Oryx and Crake here. Oh, yeah, we remember a lot of radioactive things going on for a different kind of dystopia that was on everybody's mind in those days. Annalee, was there something about the book you didn't like, parts of it, aspects?
So I think it's a fantastic book, and it's really stuck in my head for many years. But I think there are a few flaws in it. And the one that stood out to me the most is that I feel like Atwood's world building around the future of the internet is weirdly kind of flat and cartoonish and not very nuanced as compared to the way she describes the future of biotech, which I think is really complex. And she gives us this idea that in the future, it will be perfectly normal for kids to be looking at child porn and have complete access to, you know, beheading videos and violent video games. And, you know, certainly you could say, well, kids might have access to that now. But it's considered to be, but now there's a lot of moral outrage about that. I mean, people are really disturbed by that idea. It's not something that's accepted. It's something that's talked about as a big problem, even violent video games. And it's very hard for me to believe that it would be realistic that in just, you know, a short period of time, less than a century, that humans would suddenly accept the idea that, oh, it's totally fine for kids to have this like crazy libertarian access to so much media that now we consider to be absolutely beyond the pale and illegal. And these are kids who are growing up in basically the ultimate walled communities where certainly their internet use would be monitored. Mm-hmm. So that to me felt very, it kind of fell flat. And it's important to the story because our characters' mindsets are being created by this sort of terrible den of scum and villainy on the internet. And I wanted it to be a little bit more realistic, a little bit more subtle maybe.
Yeah. Let's see if we can go to the phones before we have to end. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's see. Let's try. Let's go to Jessica in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, so I'm also a scientist. And from that point of view, I wanted to say I thought the science is pretty believable. But beyond that, I really appreciate it just as a work of literature. I thought that Ms. Atwood was just using it as a story about storytelling and how the fundamental requirement of humans to be able to describe their world through story sort of couldn't be engineered out of the human being. Hmm. So particularly in the third book, which seemed to be explicitly a story about storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your people there have read all three books. So.
let me just follow up on that. You commented about one of the shortcomings. I found one of the shortcomings when I was reading was I knew so little about Oryx. You know, she's very well developed character-wise at all in that book.
Yeah, and it's surprising because I don't think of Margaret Atwood as someone who doesn't really know how to write female characters. But Oryx she's a cipher. She's very much of a stereotype. She's basically an Asian sex slave and doesn't really get to be much more than that, even when she's an adult and she kind of is playing a role in this apocalyptic plan. And so that's disappointing. And it would have been more satisfying to have her develop more. But in the later books, there are characters somewhat like her who do get a lot more time, and we kind of get to know them better.
Yeah, we recommend everybody to read Oryx and Crake and catch up on the later books. And I want to thank our panelists here, our readers at closing our Summer Science Friday book club reading. Annalee Newitz, a tech culture editor at Ars Technica, and author of the forthcoming dystopia Autonomous. We'll have you back, Annalee, to talk about Autonomous. Terry Johnson, associate teaching professor of bioengineering at UC Berkeley, author of How to Defeat Your Own Clone. Everybody should read that one. And sci-fi producer Christy Taylor. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And you can catch up with the club online and hear a recording of our special live event with Margaret Atwood in New York. If you want to hear that as a podcast, it's sciencefriday.com/bookclub. Corporate greed has taken over. Money is more important than people. Rebels hack the financial system, seeking to take down the banks. This is not Oryx and Craig. This is a battle between good and evil with cybercrime and lawlessness. And if you're a fan of the cable show Mr. Robot, you recognize why the main character, Elliot, a cybersecurity programmer, joined the hacker vigilante group F Society. And in season two, Elliot refocuses his target.
What exactly are you doing?
I'm hacking the FBI.
Whoa. I saw that episode last night, I think. Oh, well, it sounds like things are going to get complicated for Elliot and everybody there. Hacking the FBI is pretty serious. But realistic? Where do these elaborate hacks come from? That's the responsibility of my next guest. And warning, if you aren't caught up on the show, there might be a few spoilers here. Cora Don is a writer and technology producer for Mr. Robot. He's based out of Los Angeles, and he's here in our New York studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You don't shy away from showing all that code on the screen.
No, I think we're one of the first television shows to really show how it's done and have a realistic portrayal of the software and the code. I mean, I may have seen it. I know that the Matrix film used an Nmap tool, but that's about it. Most of the time, it looks like a video game.
Because I've had coders tell me I freeze the screen and I look and see if the code is real or not.
There's a whole subset of our viewership that freezes every single frame of our computer
really?
Screens. They break down the tools that we're using, the versions of the software. They look for hidden codes in the screens that we hide in there for them. It's really fun and interactive.
There are hidden codes.
A huge part of my job is incorporating Easter eggs in the show and making that level of interactivity there. So if you see IP addresses or URL web addresses or even barcodes or QR codes anywhere on the show, they will lead somewhere.
Wow.
And if you want to go down that rabbit hole, there might be a prize at the end of it.
I'm going.
It's a lot of fun.
Maybe we'll be able to list them on our website. Everybody can look at the codes.
If you can find them. There are a few that haven't been found yet.
Well, take us through the process about creating the idea for a hack. How did you come up with it, what you were going to do?
So what we do, it starts in the writer's room, and the story will always come first. So I, along with the other writers and Sam, our showrunner and our creator, will come up with the character points, the plot points, and we'll map out where our characters need to go, how they get from point A to point B in the story, and what kind of arcs and turns are there, and how we will use technology and hacking to kind of weave in and weave it into the story and get from point A to B. So usually we'll map out the story, and then there'll be a placeholder there where Sam will say, all right, Core, we need a hack here. Like, we need this piece of information.
You need a hack. We need to bring down the bank in the first.
We need to bring down Bank of E somehow.
Right.
Go figure out how to do it. So that's when I go home and do my research. And I have a whole team of consultants that work under me who are very mm-hmm. smart hackers. And we have a couple of ex-FBI consultants as well who weigh in. And we have this little technology brainstorming session that happens in tandem with our story writer's room. And we'll come up with different realistic scenarios. And then once we finalize that idea, I'll pitch it to the other writers and everyone agrees. And at that point, it's just like a paragraph in the screenplay and in the script. It's just, a couple of lines, very general, broad strokes.
When you say it's a realistic scenario, you actually have people who think about how you could hack the bank, bring it down?
Definitely.
And in this second season, you're hacking the FBI?
We are
is
hacking.
Is that possible?
The way in which we did it in season two is possible. We had numerous conversations with Andre McGregor and Michael Bazell, our two ex-FBI cyber consultants, and we talked about the nature of the network infrastructure of the FBI, how they have certain unclassified networks, and one of the things that really stood out was, you know, and like other companies, they have standard issued phones. So we thought, okay, if we have the FBI operating out of E-Corp and they're doing an investigation there, we don't have to attack the FBI field office. We can attack the FBI agents who are in that building. And if they all have the same kind of Android phone, we can write a custom-built exploit that will attack those phones and collect all the data from those phones. So that will be our kind of, you know, phishing approach, that net approach to see what kind of data we can gather from all these agents.
And you worked in cybersecurity before.
I did. I worked in cybersecurity for a major automotive company, and I did penetration testing. I developed network security policies. I did computer forensics and, you know, basically white hat hacking. And I was able to bring a lot of that experience into building out a realistic network infrastructure for Evil Corp and just tackling our hacks from an authentic place.
Take us through one of the hacks. Take us through the...
Well, in season one, if you remember, I mean, the engine for season one is taking down Evil Corp. So I met with Sam early on, and we basically mapped out all the locations of where Evil Corp would store their data. So we know that they would have a U.S. data center with local backups. We knew that they would have an off-site data center, probably, like most companies have another data center for redundancy or disaster recovery. We knew that they'd probably have off-site tape backups. So once I started to map out like the network topology of Evil Corp, that's where we were inspired to, like, all right, how would we actually take down, how would we actually destroy this data? So I'd throw out some ideas for, you know, we could use the worm that was installed in the pilot episode that Elliot installed, and we could have that encrypt all of the data in the U.S. data center. We have a Chinese hacker group that could take care of the China data center, and we have different ideas for how to tackle the offsite tapes as well. And I remember throwing out ideas like, okay, we could use magnets because, you know, it's magnetic tape, right, and we could use magnets to destroy it. But another great show, Breaking Bad, already used that idea. So that's where we came up with the climate control hack at Steel Mountain, which was a lot of fun to develop because we really got into the hardware that was used, and we were able to incorporate a little credit card-sized computer called a Raspberry Pi, which I'm sure
I knew what that was. But I was talking to my wife, said, that's a little computer, John.
Yeah, and I've never seen that in a show before, and I've never seen that be used for a major hack before. So it was a lot of fun to incorporate the Raspberry Pi and get into the nitty-gritty specifics about how we're going to hack the climate control system and, you know, up the temperature in that room so we could basically melt those tapes. And it was something that we think we were able to convey to, you know, the audience, the non-techie audience, and something that the techie audience would appreciate.
Talking with Cora Dana, writer and technology producer for Mr. Robot on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, we have a very wide-ranging audience on Science Friday, and we talk about things that everybody can understand. And then we talk about high-tech stuff. We get into high-tech stuff. We think sometimes we're getting too far into the weeds. We're not going far enough into the weeds for some people. They really want that. You know? Do you find that true, that they love to see that technology detail?
If that's one thing that I found surprising early on, and it's something that I latched onto, because once we started incorporating that level of detail into season one, I started seeing all these posts on Reddit and on Twitter and on social media of these people taking screenshots of the screens and breaking it down and looking for secret codes. And then I thought, all right, this is great. This is what they want. Let's incorporate more of these little details. And it's a huge part of my job.
Are the details also true about the personalities of the hacker?
Definitely. This is something that's interesting because I'm lucky enough to have been exposed to a lot of hackers and a lot of writers. And I know when Sam created the character of Elliot and put together the different characters of F Society, I know he used himself as which one is he? He's very close to Elliot.
Yeah.
But just in terms of the anxieties and the neuroses and the worries that writers go through, and, you know, the isolation and the loneliness and just being able to lock yourself in a room and work on a script and solve a story problem. It's very similar to that of a hacker. There are a lot of hackers who are socially awkward. There are a lot of writers who are socially awkward. I've spoken to a lot of hackers who say that, you know, they were huge introverts before they started going to different hacker conferences like DEF CON and Black Hat, and that's where they really met other people like them, and they were able to talk about, you know, learn how to talk to people. So we used a lot of that and incorporated a lot of that into our hacker characters, our members of F Society.
Yeah, we're seeing so much in the arts. We were talking about Oryx and Crake before, a dystopian society. Dystopia has become such a meme these days. And in Mr. Robot, Elliot and the F Society start out with good intentions, but it quickly goes bad. Well, doesn't it? Can hackers not be shown as good people at the end? You know, people who are not trying to take something down, but to build something up? Because they start saying they want to do that, but toward the end of the episode, they're saying, boy, did we make a mistake. I'm using euphemistic language.
No, definitely. And the series is not over yet, so we don't really know where this is going. But it's the intentions were good. Yeah. I mean, if you watch season one, you can get on board with their plan. Elliot wanted to save the world, and maybe perhaps F Society was a little naive with that plan. And this season is all about the consequences and repercussions of that decision of taking down Evil Corp. Yeah, erasing the debt sounds like a great idea, but it's obvious that they didn't think things through all the way. And I think that's something that people involved in hacktivism or hackers or young and angry, militant viewers out there who latch on to season one and be like, yeah, that's great. I think it's intriguing and compelling to see the fallout of that and see how our characters deal with the fact that maybe they were wrong. Maybe they didn't think this all the way through.
Hmm. Well, this prison angle has got me, I'm thinking a little further in advance, got me a little shaky. Everybody have to watch and see what I'm talking about. So I'm not giving anything away.
You give a little bit away.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Just a little. Get everybody keep watching. Cora Donner, writer and technology producer for Mr. Robot. Thank you very much. It's a great show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mr. Robot's on Wednesdays at 10 on USA Network.
In USA, right? Yep.
And you can find a few of the Mr. Robot Easter eggs, which you talked about, on our website at sciencefriday.com/MRRobot. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And as I say, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and you see the more of the podcast of Oryx and Crake up there with Margaret Atwood is up there. And also we blog, we're on Facebook. You know the drill. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.